Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
Welcome to Work is Weird Now. We have already had quite a weird morning with some technical difficulties, so I'm happy to say that we all seem to be connected and working now. We have something special for you today. This is a little bit of a one-off episode. In the context of all of our conversations about work, we've had the same topic come up again and again, which is education, which maybe isn't surprising because most people we've interviewed have had something to say about the role that education plays in preparing or not preparing people for the world of work. And most of the conversations we've had have been quite critical about whether or not education is actually adequately preparing young people for the world of work. And so what we've decided to do, in the interest of making sure that we can provide both sides of the conversation, we have invited a special guest here today to talk to us about this very topic. So please, Sarah, introduce yourself.
Good morning. I'm Sarah Thomas, and I'm an assistant head in the independent sector. I work in secondary education. And I've also have about 15 years of experience working in the state sector prior to my current role.
Fantastic. Really good to have you here. I think we're going to have a great discussion. Just for the sake of transparency, Sarah and I know each other socially and have been friends for quite a long time and have had many interesting conversations about education in general already. And so I thought this would be a great opportunity to bring her on and hear some of the things that she has to say about the current state of play in education and what the future is in terms of its role in preparing children for work. So the first question I wanted to ask you was, how should education be preparing people for the new world of work?
I think one of the things I would ask us maybe to imagine is how we feel about perhaps taking a four-year-old to their first day of reception. I'm not sure how many of us have had that experience who might be listening, but when it feels like, yeah, exactly.
I've got this coming up in September.
Do you? Yeah.
I feel very seen already.
Right. So, you know, how does it feel if you've got a four-year-old, quite a young human being, who you're kind of walking to the school gates the first time and like walking them into the playground and into this kind of, you know, building and space where we know they're going to be spending quite a lot of time. And when we think about sending them off, are we thinking, gosh, I hope they come out as a good employee? You know, most of us probably are not thinking that way when our children start school. And I think that gets at the heart of the fact that while preparing children for the world of work is one of the purposes of education, and certainly in our society, it's one of the metrics that we use to kind of determine whether education has succeeded or not, it's certainly not the sole purpose of education. And therefore, when we talk about like how should schools be preparing children for the world of work, we have to consider that alongside the other tensions and purposes that education is meant to serve in our society.
So if we talk about secondary school education, then how have you seen education change, let's say, in the last, well, in the number of years that you've been doing it in response to what's happening out in the real world?
Sure. Well, I think kind of starting with how education has changed is probably just a good one more broadly. Like, what is the landscape of education kind of around it? And, you know, of course, education is a social service and a public good, which I think is another way of defining it, right? It's a public good, not one for the private sector necessarily. And therefore, it serves multiple purposes. But education in the sector has changed enormously since I started. You know, you have had conversations, I've listened to some of the other episodes with people about how their industries have changed, how the world of work is changing. It's kind of the function of the podcast, right? Of course, in the same way, education has changed enormously and society is changing at a really rapid rate. We are seeing a huge change in terms of the economy, the kind of what it takes to kind of raise a family in the economy. You know, we typically have a situation now where you have to have two earners 9 times out of 10 or to make things work for children. It's a very expensive proposition. The cost of living has skyrocketed. We're seeing a rise in poverty. The gap between the rich and the poor is rising exponentially. And all of these things, of course, have a huge impact on education. And in the same way that we think about the impact of the pandemic and lockdown as having had a massive impact on the world of work and what that looks like, what people expect from their jobs, whether or not work is a place, et cetera, of course, that's had a massive impact as well on schools and education and what it looks like. And we're still recovering from that. So in terms of this idea that, you know, education, I think sometimes the way it's described is that, you know, it's not very responsive. It hasn't changed much. It's just kind of like is still a Victorian institution that doesn't adapt very well to modern society. I would argue that that's not the case. You know, I think if we look at large corporations, we could also accuse them of similar things. And there is an issue here around the size of organizations and therefore how responsive can they be to kind of the fast-paced change, nature of change in society. But schools, of course, have adapted hugely already and are working hard to make gains to continue to serve children and families. But we're doing so in a landscape that is incredibly challenging.
Yeah. So what are maybe one or two of those big changes that have happened?
Well, I was thinking a little bit about the nature of just school and attendance actually prior to this call. So one of the biggest issues we have, say, post-pandemic is a rise in attendance and struggling with attendance and getting people to actually be in school. There's always been a percentage of the population that struggles to come into school on a regular basis for a variety of reasons, struggles to engage with the system. And we've seen a rapid rise in that post-COVID as well. I was thinking about the fact, you know, one of the questions here is kind of like, well, what services are we already offering in terms of careers support and careers training, which of course schools do, that's already part of the curriculum. But what are the issues that we have? I was thinking about, you know, in a previous podcast, one of your guests was talking about the very high number of NEETs or children who are not in education, employment, or training, which is on the rise, and the fact that, you know, we want to close this gap. And of course we do. But one of the issues I was thinking about is the fact that actually a huge number of the children and young people who will be caught up in that statistic will themselves have had trouble attending school. And so it doesn't necessarily matter in that instance what schools are delivering if the students and children who are we're meant to serve are not actually able to access that for a variety of reasons. So that is one thing that is incredibly challenging. And the government has been talking a huge amount about it. How do we measure attendance? How do we help students get back on site? How do we support families who may be struggling with attendance issues? But that's a massive concern that schools have had to adapt to in the aftermath of COVID in particular.
Do you think that's because children are having more kind of anxiety around being in person and that sort of thing, and COVID's exacerbated that because they've been removed effectively from society? Or do you think there's just a sort of common belief that because we now know that, and this is true with work too, because we now know that we can do things remotely, that actually there's not a need to be there in person to access the same kind of learning that you would have before?
That could take me on a little bit of a tangent with that one. So that's a really interesting question. I do think primarily with children and young people, we're not looking at people who are just like, well, I can do my math from the living room now. That doesn't tend to be what we're seeing. We're not seeing like a super high demand for, you know, say online schooling. An increase, sure. And is that going to be appropriate in some context or some children? Absolutely. But that's not really what we're seeing. And I think most of us, again, if we think about children at the forefront of education, just kind of imagine young people, you know, in the pandemic, I don't think we were particularly keen to have our young people, to have children kind of sat in front of screens the whole time accessing education, which again gets at the heart of like, what is the purpose of education? And one purpose of education is socialization and relationship building. And therefore, you know, this idea that we're just going to move education online and it's all going to be perfect and that's going to work out really well is probably, well, we've kind of seen how that experiment went. So I would suggest that that's probably not an alternative that we're looking at for the vast majority of people. So then it does suggest then that one of the main issues around attendance and engagement is around anxiety, mental health issues, and I think also a sense of kind of engagement in, well, in the social sphere. A lot of us, if we think again about as adults our experience post-pandemic, will have found a kind of transition out of lockdown and back into the social sphere that we were more used to, probably overwhelming. I mean, think about the first time you went back on public transportation, took a flight, you know, had to kind of do something that you hadn't done in quite a long time. And it felt strange and a little bit uncomfortable because we weren't used to it. You know, we'd moved out of that comfort zone. And so young people were the same. You know, schools are, of course, overwhelming places. They're hugely stimulating. They're busy. They're noisy. There's a lot going on. And so it probably isn't surprising that some young people have found that transition back into school quite difficult. And of course, what we know is that becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The less often you go, the harder it is to get back in. We have a new term for this now in education. We call it emotion-based school avoidance. We used to call the children who didn't come school refusers. So it's quite a critical term. So we have a different kind of level of terminology for that now. But that is a really significant thing. I would also say, though, of course, that the other thing that's compounding this is what we're seeing is a national and international rise in the number of young people being diagnosed with special educational needs. You know, the term neurodivergence and neurodiversity is something that's becoming a kind of popular part of the lexicon that we use. And we know, of course, you know, all of us will either be consider ourselves neurodivergent or know people, often people who are quite close to us who fit into that label and those the categories that are there. Those categories are, I always say, quite flexible and quite loose. But that is a huge rise in the world of education. And it's not just something in the UK. It's something that's happening globally. And schools are having to adapt. And they're having to adapt on a dime, but without a dime, to use the American expression, which is we're having to pivot really quickly to try and meet this very rapid rise in need without a significant amount of funding, without the level of training and investment that schools need to meet the needs of young people. And I think that's an incredibly difficult thing. And it is gets at the heart of both that kind of figure around NEETs, children who aren't engaged, and also it gets at the heart of like, what are some of the struggles that schools are having to manage alongside preparing people for the workforce? And it's a really challenging landscape.
Yeah, I think there's definitely no question that your job has become significantly harder. And there are a number of obviously different things that are affecting that in terms of sort of societal pressures and so on. One of the things that we began to discuss when we were on our discovery call yesterday and then decided that we would hold off until we had the opportunity to discuss here is the idea of knowledge transfer, right? So we all know that if you speak to anybody who works in the field of AI, they will claim that the need for knowledge coming out of human beings' brains is probably no longer going to be relevant because there's going to be a massive white-collar revolution. We will have potentially beings that are not human being smarter than us, more intelligent than us, and more capable of retaining knowledge than us, and not only retaining it, but actually accessing, analyzing, bringing it all together, that sort of thing. So what is the role of education in your mind in terms of the kind of conventional ideas around providing young people with knowledge?
I'm so glad you asked, but I am slightly afraid this is going to take us down quite a kind of edu-nerdy trend here. So
go for it.
This is one of the classic kind of debates in the world of education, and there will be people out there in the world of education who disagree with me on this matter, although I think personally that the research is clear about it, which is we kind of see knowledge on the one hand and skills on the other. And employers tend to talk about education this way, and it's a way that a lot of us conceptualize kind of like the things that are taught to people and in our own lives. You know, on the one hand, you have information, on the other hand, you have like what you do with it or how you behave. And this is a false dichotomy. And I think people kind of first of all are like, oh, of course it's a false dichotomy. We shouldn't teach knowledge or skills. We should teach knowledge and skills. And actually, that is still a bit of a misconception around how we learn, around how we become good at things. So knowledge encapsulates skills, or rather, skill is a type of knowledge. You cannot have skill in the absence of knowledge. And there's a few different ways of thinking about this, which is, you can see skills as very small components of knowledge, but a better way of thinking about it is actually that in order to be an expert at something, in order to be good at something, you're accessing a vast amount of knowledge that you have. So we might say something like, you know, we want children to be, forget about the knowledge, you know, they don't need to know about the Industrial Revolution or the start of the Second World War, or, you know, I don't know, algebraic formulas. They just need to know how to be really good problem solvers. Well, unfortunately, you don't get to be a good problem solver if you don't have a vast store of knowledge. And the idea that that knowledge can kind of sit outside of you, outside of your brain, and then you can just go and pull it and then solve all those problems is, again, a kind of false assumption around how the human brain works and about how we get good at things. So that kind of suggestion doesn't really hold up in the world of education. Is it true that there's going to be a vast amount of information that's stored at our fingertips and we have access to that? Sure. But even the process of sifting through that information, knowing what kinds of prompts and commands, what kind of search terms that we need for information, what to ask, and then to make judgments and evaluate that information requires domain expertise. So you're not able to write a good command prompt on something or evaluate the validity of something without a vast amount of knowledge that you already possess. And if we think about, you know, we kind of have this idea, you know, information is exploding. It is. And the quality of that information is hugely problematic, right? So not only are we going to be living in a world where we have these vast stores of information, we also know that a lot of that information isn't going to be either relevant, you know, best case scenario, or true, worst case scenario. So in that sense, we do really have to work with young people to help them develop the knowledge that they need in order to be successful, to develop the kinds of skills that are going to enable them to survive in the workplace.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
So much sense. And it's taking me back to one of the recordings that is about to come out actually in a couple of weeks' time. our guest raised a really valid point around the broad landscape of secondary, and almost it felt like we were trained to complete exams. How many do you do at seniors now? Is it still 11, 12?
National average is about 7 GCSEs, but you can do up to 10 or 11.
Yeah. And then almost it whittles back to, if you go into higher education, but into A-levels, it's down to like 4 or 5. But the way you've just laid it all out there is so very clear, because we are in a world now where you can just go and tap something into ChatGPT and it'll produce a response for you. But how do you know that that's right? Are you then being inquisitive of that response to go and flush out the detail and the references and trust that it's a decent reference, etc.? We are in a digital world. It's coming at everybody from all angles, not just learning, but social as well. And there needs to be a level of resilience around that for kids now. And it's happening in primary as well as secondary, which
absolutely,
as a parent who's got a kid going to school in September, I'm terrified at what is about to come and what I need to do as a parent to like set this up for him. Not that he's got a phone or anything yet, but you know what I mean? And I just wanted to touch on that because Holly really went into the fact that she's invested in a personal coach around mindset to help her with her resilience, to help her make sure that she doesn't burn out, because all those things can happen quite quickly because you can become consumed by demand and need and comparison. Are schools, and is the curriculum helping with that, or are there like any gaps that you can foresee coming with the way that the world of work and just the way the digital world is now?
Sure. So yeah, I think Holly's comments on mindset were so important and so interesting. And I do think, you know, of course, you know, one of the things about young people that you're aiming is not just to impart knowledge. And I think that's one of the ways that the debate kind of sometimes gets a bit sidelined around that, which is, you know, oh, you're teaching them all these facts and this information, but are you teaching them like how to be good people or how to have, you know, kind of the values and qualities that will make you successful? And, you know, of course, schools already have a huge framework around how we educate young people from a pastoral point of view and the amount of support we give them. You know, one of the reasons I actually love working in this country, I've worked in the US as well, in education, is because of that pastoral framework. And I do think that the UK does that well in comparison to many other countries, and doesn't mean that we can't do it better. It's not room for improvement. But I think the fact that schools are judged on the level of pastoral care, which includes things like working on resilience, working on self-esteem, working on developing the other personal qualities that we would want, you know, grit, et cetera, collaboration, all of those things are part of the pastoral framework in which schools operate and in which they're judged, right, by regulators like Ofsted, for example. And I think that's really critical. Of course, there's going to be a huge variation in how well schools do this. Still, you know, the quality of the type of curriculum around pastoral care is, you know, an issue. I think there's maybe less support than there is for what we perceive as academic curriculum. I would also say, though, that one of the things I think we have to be a little bit careful about is suggesting that young people are going to be learning these skills in like isolated lessons. Like, you know, I'm going to have a lesson on self-confidence. I'm going to have a lesson on grit. Well, these are not skills, as, you know, again, as adults, sometimes we make demands of the education system and then you apply them to like our own lives. You're like, well, of course that wouldn't work. Like, you know, are we going to go and sit and be like, you know what, today I'm going to spend an hour of my life learning about grit? No, you develop grit through like experience. This is a life thing. And school is the same. And, you know, one of the things about school is helping students to understand, you know, when they come with like, oh, you know, why do I have to learn this random geometry? You know, maths is so hard. You know, you're like, yeah, it is hard. But learning how to do hard things is a really important life skill. And that's why we're going to persist with this, because your ability to reason numerically is one of the things that's going to make you a good problem solver. Are you going to have to actually bust out, you know, some kind of like Pythagoras' theorem on something? Probably not, right? On the other hand, it does build a foundation for the way that you see the world, for the way that you rationalize things, for your ability to understand the complexity of the world in which we live. And I think that that's really important. So, you know, schools do have these kinds of curriculums around the kind of skills that we want. But realistically, what schools, and if you ask them, probably prefer to do, are to try and deliver these in a real world, in an academic context, but also through things like experiential trips, right? That's a really important part of education. But it's very difficult now that I'm in the independent sector and I see the level of service that comes to children who are in the independent sector. It's very difficult for state schools to compete with that. It's really hard to offer those experiences to families, especially at this time when we're feeling the economic pinch. But I do think that that's the place where they're often best delivered.
So you're doing a really good job of defending an education system, which is exactly what we would expect. And But what I'm wondering is, if you had a magic wand and you could wave it and change something about secondary education and how it's delivered without thinking about what's happening on the outside. So just, you know, we know there's lots of problems. There's lots of things that are showing up on your plate and at your doorstep that you have to contend with. But let's just ignore those things for a minute. Looking at the context of work and the world that we live in right now, what would you change about secondary education if you could just do whatever you wanted with it?
That's a great question. Yeah, I'm a lifer in the education system at this stage. So, of course, I am very protective about the work that teachers and educators do. It's a very hard job. Yeah, and there's not enough of us. But I can also criticize it with the best of them. So there are so many things about the world of education that are hugely frustrating. And, you know, in terms of, we frame that in terms of the world of work. I mean, the first, even before I get to that bit about like, what should schools be doing? Part of it is the how. And I do think that, you know, we want to think about schools as institutions and how they function in society. So there's kind of education, which we have this expectation of like, what are kids learning, what's happening, et cetera. But schools also have become a bit like hospitals or GP practices. You know, they are institutions that also deliver kind of social initiatives. So think about free school meals, you know, of which I am a huge proponent and so lucky that we benefit from universal free school meals in London for the last few years. But schools are delivering social policy. So there are a lot of things that schools do that are not directly about education, but we deliver because of our connection with families and young people. And, you know, the first thing I would say in terms of helping education to be more successful is that either we have got to invest in those kinds of services and provision for schools so that they are able to better serve families and young people and meet the needs of those families in this kind of change, time of economic change. That's one possibility. The other possibility is, of course, investing more broadly in services and social services outside of schools. So we will not see a significant change in the preparation of the workforce until we see an investment in care. And that is just not going to happen. And that is an issue really for us as a society to decide how much do we want to invest or not. So that has to be the first thing. None of this is going to happen and without that level of investment and care and support. The second thing I think to think about then is kind of like, well, this kind of tension perhaps between employers and schools. And going back slightly to the knowledge debate, you know, you get this thing where employers are kind of like, you know, they really need to teach them what they need to know for the world of work. And you're like, okay, so when I think about when I was growing up and I was in school, should I have been mastering like the art of WordPerfect and BASIC? You know, I learned how to type on a typewriter. That was how I first learned. Those skills are obsolete immediately. When we think about the knowledge that we teach, and when employers are kind of like, you know, you need to be teaching them Python, you need to be teaching them this, it's all going to go. Because if you think about knowledge, actually, recent knowledge is the knowledge that goes obsolete the fastest, you know, Betamax, VHS, microfiche storage. It's the recent development in technology and knowledge that is replaced very quickly. The alphabet, right, our numbering system, which has been around since ancient times, that knowledge persists and is still fundamental to this day. So, you know, the first thing is I think that schools have got to not be tempted by employers to kind of embrace this attitude of, you know, AI is a classic one. We're getting that right now. Like suddenly, you know, schools have got to make sure that kids know exactly how to engage with AI all the time. Should it be on the list? Absolutely. Do we need to think about it? Yes. Is it coming? Yes. Does that mean that that needs to replace the kind of foundational knowledge that we've been teaching children for a very long time? Probably not. And we need to be really cautious about that. That's one reason, because the knowledge becomes obsolete. But the other reason we have to be careful about allowing employers in the private sector to maybe dictate what we're doing in terms of careers education is because they have a very poor understanding of child development. So one of the other reasons why we don't necessarily teach people just the kind of knowledge or skills that they might need for the workplace is because we are coming into the workforce with our kind of brains already wired. We've already had this developmental experience. We've solidified how our brains work. We have deployed them to learn how to read, et cetera. But young people don't have that, even quite late into really, I mean, realistically, their early 20s, but certainly into adolescence. Brains are quite malleable. They are learning through the acquisition of knowledge, like how to, I don't know, there's an expression, neurons that fire together, wire together, right? So they're learning how to get their neural networks up and running in a specific way. And so we have to be really cautious about just bringing down the adult world into the world of children and child development. So that's just another kind of point of caution. I still probably haven't said what you want, which is what should we be doing? So I think one of the biggest things I really think that schools do a little bit of, but could do more of, and this is also maybe going to places where your listeners can help us, is this concept of work experience. One of the things that still happens, I don't know, because I, of course, wasn't educated in this country. It wasn't actually part of my upbringing, but the idea of work experience has been around, I think, since I've been teaching here. Dan, I don't know, did you do work experience when you were going to school?
Did I? I've got so much to say on all of this, but yes, I did.
Go on.
I did my work experience at a animal shelter and kennels, where I basically walked dogs for a week and picked up dog poo for a week and played with kittens. Because I wanted to be a vet, right? And I wanted to be a vet because I loved animals. And I think it was year 9 or year 10, did the questionnaire in our one careers class that we had. I can still smell the room. I can see the teacher in his check shirt. He was hilarious. There was one dusty computer in the room. And we all had to take it in turns to do the questionnaire to see what our profession was going to be. Right? And lo and behold, mine came out as a vet because I loved animals. So they sent me off to this animal shelter. Tick. I am very average academically, right? Found out when I was 22 that I was dyslexic, which probably like indicates why I struggled in the exam format at times. But I'm your average kind of student, but did pretty well in sport and did pretty well in business studies. Hence, I've then fallen into marketing. But the fact that nobody sat me down with these grades to be like, really, you know, vet needs like straight A's, A stars, and still went through it and went into A level and then failed first round of A levels doing all the sciences, just did terribly. And it's the work experience thing for me is so important. And it's like goes back to that like passion, or is it the true academic backing and having that support system around you of what's it going to be? But then since that, I've throughout my career try to give work experience opportunities where I kind of then open up other doors, because I think having that interface and that experience with as many different types of workplaces is so important now, to understand different types of like industries, different office setups, different, you know, all of those things. Because I want to go back again, because I think now about the careers that were put on the table to me in that room, it was doctors, lawyers, which, you know, go and work in an office, you go work on a building site, or you go be a vet. It was just so basic. Whereas now, if a kid walked into a room and was like, I'm going to be the next Taylor Swift, or I'm going to be the next Mr. Beast, or whatever he's called, you could go, all right, yeah, because they could be, you know, they could quite easily do all of that from their phone. So it's just such a different environment now. And I think we've all got responsibilities, workplaces do, as a parent, you know, a caregiver, whoever else the people are, about giving that exposure, because it's like it's all possible, right? But then how do you make sure that you've got that structure and framework around people to help them in that way that they want to go?
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think work experience, I think you've described what is often a very typical work experience. Although I think there is, you know, one of the things I was struck that Holly said was the fact that, you know, how actually, even though she has succeeded and is succeeding, she's in the process of succeeding, that it wasn't as easy and straightforward as she perhaps thought it was going to be. And I think we have to be a little bit cautious with young people who do come to us and say, you know, I want to be the next Mr. Beast. And it's kind of like, well, that's great. But, you know, we can work towards those skills, but the odds are perhaps against you. And you need to have a few strands here. And also you need to understand that level of grit. Like, what is it going to take to succeed in this? So I think there's an element of, yes, it's changing, but also some of the things that enable us to succeed are still really important. And I think, you know, work experience is critical. And I would say it's particularly critical in the state sector, because we know that we kind of propose to live in a meritocracy. Of course we don't. And careers are often built on connection and social networks. Do things like LinkedIn and social media help to break down some of those barriers of opportunity? Sure. But actually, you know, they still persist enormously. Someone who needs to get capital funding to become the next Mr. Beast or whatever it is that they're going to do is going to need a network to help them to raise that. They're going to need, we kind of have this idea, you know, digital natives, because they're surrounded by technology, they understand how it works and how to use it. And of course, that's also false. If you actually look at the average teen and their level of kind of tech literacy, can they make a TikTok? Yeah. But are they actually able to figure out the kind of mechanisms required to create content on a regular basis? You know, that's a whole nother thing. And I think it's really important that we widen those access opportunities. Unfortunately, in the state sector, a lot of the work experience is very heavily limited by the connections of often the teachers, if I'm honest, and sometimes the parents of that school. But that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I would say that investing in work experience opportunities for young people is a really critical thing. And it's something that, can we wait for a government initiative to do it? Sure. Do large corporations have policies around work experience? Yes. but also it's something you can do now, which is if you are in a company, even your own company, and you have the capacity to mentor someone, you know, work experience is usually a week at most, reach out to the local state school and see if they'll help connect you with someone. It's a really critical thing to do. And that breadth of experience is really pivotal, which is they still tend to be quite typical. You know, a lot of our students actually go work in our primary school, my previous place. So in the independent sector, work experience tends to be organized outside of term time. But in the state sector, you know, I worked at an all-through school, and it tended to be that a lot of our students who couldn't get placements, well, you're going to go help out in the primary school for the week, which wasn't a terrible thing, but probably also not exposing them to the kind of career breadth that we would like young people to have. And that's a really important thing that schools can do.
What is the perception that you hear at the moment of people in your age school of work? Because there's been so much amazing marketing content around this over the past few years. There was the whole "What is a CEO" campaign. It was in every like variety. It was a man, and I that was such a powerful campaign. But also, like going back to my time in school, if you worked in an office, you know, you went there 9 to 5, and you went there for your whole career. And interestingly, like my partner's parents, they still have that. Will you dedicate your life to a company kind of mindset, where it's so different now. And I've mentioned in previous episodes that I've managed Gen Z for quite some time, but you know, they all start off like, I'm going to be here for 5 to 10 years. And I'm like, you're not. And that's fine, because actually they want to industry hop, you know, do a couple of years, try different places to experience it all. And I really admire that mindset. But I suppose with the next generation coming through, Gen Alpha, what are you hearing, feeling from them?
Yeah, I think just before I get onto what I'm hearing from them, I think that's such an interesting point. And this idea, you know, we do talk about work a lot that way. You know, it's no longer a career for life or a profession for life that you're going to move around. I mean, we have all experienced that already. So I don't know that that's necessarily, I mean, I'm probably unusual, which is the thing I started doing at 22 is still more or less the thing that I do now. And for my sins, I think. But career of passion. You know, that's already unusual. But I think to suggest that it's only because employees want to do lots of different things is probably a little bit false, right? So one of the issues we have, and this is the other reason I'm always quite hard on employers kind of saying the workforce isn't ready. The investment from employers in their workforce has never been lower. You know, we're in a gig economy now, in which people are just moving around, not because necessarily they want to, but because they're put on temp contracts and they don't get the same benefits. You know, the kind of security that we used to get from companies, that sense of like loyalty, worked both ways. And we don't have that anymore. And I think young people, you know, as you have explored in previous episodes, but feel very frustrated with that and angry, rightly so, because they feel that nothing is guaranteed for them. And I think, you know, again, this is a pretty big disparity depending on what type of context you're in. So, you know, in the independent sector right now, it's not exclusively true, but I would say a lot of my students have that breadth of exposure to different types of careers, often because their parents work in a very broad variety of fields. We do also, of course, work very hard to ensure that they're introduced to that through like an online lecture series is one of the things that we do. I would love to see that kind of concept brought into the state sector in a wider way. I think it's an easy thing that could be deployed to support young people. And we have at my current school kind of every half term, there's an online lecture with 2 or 3 panelists from a particular industry, and they come on and have a conversation, and students can log in and parents as well and listen to that dialogue and ask them questions, et cetera. And I think that's a really helpful thing to do. So I think exposure is really important, but on the whole, I think younger people feel really frustrated. You know, they don't have a great conception of what work is. So I think they don't have a great understanding of what it takes to succeed, even in this new digital landscape, what it means, like how do you actually get revenue from running a YouTube channel? What are the kinds of things that you have to consider in terms of that? How do you pay taxes and estimate that? How do you set up a business? So I don't think they have a great conception of what is changing about work. And I don't think they feel particularly optimistic that it is there to serve them. I think there's very much a sense, of course, that the economy right now is not driven by the needs of workers. And it's driven by the gains from people primarily at the top. And, you know, young people, they're not missing a trick. They're listening to everything that's happening, and they know that that's the case. And I think it's one of the reasons why engagement with education and the workforce more broadly is low.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to just touch on was just when you were speaking about your own work experience, Dan, I was just thinking about my experience when I was in secondary school. Mine was maybe a little bit of an anomaly in that I went to a very small independent school, Catholic school in the US. And so my experience would definitely be different from other people's. But one of the most interesting and meaningful things that that school did was that they required us to do quite a lot of community service. So it was just part of the contract with the school. And so I did all sorts of quote unquote jobs over the course of my time there. I worked in hospitals, I worked in food banks, I worked all over my own community in terms of gaining some work experience, but not necessarily relevant to what the things I was going to be doing once I left school, but very much grounded me in the place that I was a part of. And I think what I was struck by when my children were in a state primary school was how little of that connection existed with the local community. So not really a local sense of pride, no real sense of local history. We live in a place in a community within London that has an incredible history right on the doorstep that was never brought into the curriculum. That connection was never made. And I'm just wondering, Sarah, from your perspective, is that something that you're seeing more of at the secondary school level? Is it something that would actually benefit children as they go through school? Because I think work in particular is not going to look like what we think is going to look like. And there is an argument that many people would make that if the utopian version of this AI revolution happens, we will all be on universal basic income. Exactly. Right. So we actually have an opportunity to do something else that is productive and meaningful to us. And then we've also got the loneliness epidemic and all these other things that are kind of compounding this fraying of the relationship we have with our local community. Is that something that secondary schools are looking at? Is it something they should be looking at moving forward?
I love that you've raised this. I think it's so important. And how, I want to use the word frustrating, I'm not quite sure that's the right one, but that, you know, our local primary school didn't engage with those things. It is really critical. And I think that that level of community engagement, one of the reasons why it's a little different, I will say, just from the US-UK perspective, is that the safeguarding measures put in place in this country often make it quite difficult for schools to engage young people in volunteerism in the same level that we might do in the US. It's one of the things that I found a bit surprising when I came here, having had quite a strong background in volunteering community service when I was in school myself. That said, while it's an obstacle, it's not one that's unsolvable. So I think it's certainly something schools should work towards. In my experience, schools do often work towards this. My last state school, had quite a significant community program, both within kind of the school itself, which is that students are expected to volunteer to do all kinds of things, whether that's bake sales or read with younger children or work with parents when they came in to fill in surveys and translate perhaps for them as needed. You know, there is an expectation in certainly some state secondary schools that you're going to be involved in the community and also working on that kind of local history. We had a great time at my last place when we hit, I can't remember what particular anniversary it was, but we went out and it's the last place is quite a community school. You know, it's one of those places, if you don't live within a quarter mile, you don't get in. So the people who went to the school actually still often live very close. And so you have generations of people who've been educated by the school who live in very close proximity. And so on one of these anniversaries, it might've been the 100th anniversary of the school's existence, they brought in a selection of people who'd been educated there and did like an oral history project with some of the children actually in primary school. And I think a couple of the secondary students were helpers. So I think it's absolutely critical, those kinds of initiatives. And exactly what you said is it helps us to understand, you know, work experience is not only about how it benefits the individual and their goals, but it's also about how it builds links and connections between communities and how we understand our relationship with the people who are around us. And I think that's a really critical initiative, and I'd like to see more of it. I would say that in the classic way, though, the hardest thing is schools are expected to deliver a lot. So whenever you're talking about those kinds of initiatives, who's going to be responsible for coordinating that? When does it happen? What lessons do they miss? You know, and is there kind of a funding initiative that goes with it? What about transportation? You know, like all of these things are huge questions that can be, what can initially sound like quite a simple solution can sometimes be much more complicated in reality to deliver. That said, I don't think it should stop us from having that aim.
And how do you think, or how does, just from a real like layman's term perspective, for someone who doesn't know, probably about to learn, how does primary and secondary dovetail?
Strengthen.
This is a fantastic topic. I'm really glad you've asked this one because it's a real passion of mine. So I think a little bit about how I came into education, which is I have a degree in English and in politics, and I really love my subject. And even though I love children and have my own children, And loved them when they were very little. I did not have a particular passion for working with very young children when I was a young adult myself. And so, you know, a lot of people always think that working with teenagers sounds quite scary. I sometimes think that working with toddlers sounds even scarier. So I was a secondary specialist very quickly from day one. And I love teaching my discipline. It's something I'm really passionate about and I enjoy in the way that I think that it both serves people who may go on to study English and have things directly tied to that, but also just serves all of us in terms of the way that stories enrich our lives. But that said, understood that primary education was important. I understood that early education was important from a research point of view, but I probably didn't quite get exactly how significant it is until I had children of my own. And I think once you've had children of your own, you have seen the absolute magic that is early learning and the critical importance of what happens in those early years. And by early years, there's the early years foundation stage, which includes reception, but I also mean, you know, from birth, really. That learning journey for children begins so early. And all of us, you know, Oxbridge professors are standing on the shoulders of early years giants. And we have got to have an education system and really a society that places more value on what happens to young people even before they enter school. So that transition point between primary and secondary, and is there an issue there? And what do we do? Absolutely. This is a huge focus for schools. This is a mandated place where schools work very hard to help support the transition from primary to secondary, because we do see a learning dip for the vast majority of children in that transition from year 6 into year 7. Sometimes we also see it in other key transition points. So into A-level and sometimes at the start of university, there are kind of, you know, slightly rocky points, but that year 6 to 7 transition is a really critical one. And schools will have very significant plans, and people who are appointed, it's part of their remit, it is part of mine in my current job, to ensure that that transition goes well and figure out how to minimize that gap and make it as easy as possible for people. What I would say, though, is part of the issue. You've asked, are they ready when they come up into year 7? You know, my colleagues in primary education do an exceptional job of preparing young people and teaching them everything from how to tie their shoelaces to how to read to how to, you know, manage all kinds of situations. And they do it at a really incredible level. That said, if they're only turning up age 4, we're already too late. Those gaps already exist. And it is very difficult to close the gap for children who arrive age 4 for reception, who do not have the kind of language skills and knowledge that they need, who have not had the kind of exposure to play-rich environments, literate environments that lay that foundation for success very early on. And we have seen over the course of my career, even if I think about, oh, I don't know, less than 10 years ago, you know, the stripping back during austerity of the funding for the kinds of family programs that support children and young people. You know, at my last school, they run from nursery to age 18, and we have an on-site nursery, which offers provision. Before that, we also had a family community center that was open to anyone with babies, and they would come, and there was programming from the community and the local authority for them. That's gone now. We just couldn't afford to keep it running. And it was really devastating. We had a parent protest at the time with parents saying, you know, this is the thing that saved me after I had my baby. I really needed these resources. I needed the outlet. And I think we've got to think about that point of transition from year 6 to 7 is a critical one, but everything is catch up based on where children start. And it's one of those reasons why, again, when we talk about education, when we talk about preparing the workforce, we're talking about families, and that exists beyond the remit only of schools. And we have to be thinking about what does that support for families look like? I'm sure you can think about families and work in terms of parental leave policies and what that is required and what's needed there, but it also goes right back to how we support families at a societal level.
Yeah.
So just a couple more questions and then we'll let you go. At the moment in the workforce, Gen Z and Gen Alpha get quite a bad reputation. As somebody who works with these people every day, pitch me on what is great about this generation of young people.
What is great about this generation of young people is the same thing that's great about young people in general, which is their enthusiasm for life and their, you know, we talk about teaching resilience. You don't need to teach these kids resilience. They have already been quite resilient. So, you know, it's the other reason sometimes we're kind of like, you know, teach them these lessons about grit. I'm like, do you know what? They have already exhibited a lot of grit just by making it through the education system, which is, you've heard all my praise for it and the things that we do. It's still a very difficult system to get through. The current state of GCSE qualifications is absolutely grueling. I'm a big fan of knowledge, as you now know. I would argue that probably the level of knowledge or the amount of knowledge covered at GCSE is a little bit too broad at the national level. It's probably not suitable for everyone. So the thing that makes the current generations of young people coming up great are that they're still trying. Like, you know, we see the number of NEETs going up. But actually, a lot of those young people are still trying to get into the workforce. They want to succeed. They feel disappointed that they didn't get the qualifications they wanted and maybe disconnected from that. But they're still going for it. You know, you think about the amount of resilience that they're already exhibiting, I think, to have come through. Everyone we're still educating has been part of the pandemic and has come through what is a very difficult time for them developmentally. And they're living at a time of huge uncertainty. Again, kids are not ignorant about this. You know, they hear the chatter, they hear the grown-ups around them talking, and they still turn up. Like, they're still there having a go, making friends, trying to navigate social situations. And I think that we underestimate them hugely from our end. And they, given the opportunity, will demonstrate their willingness to try and adapt and learn new things. And I think in some ways, we kind of resent them for being more boundaried occasionally than we are. You know, it's like we teach them, we talk about mental health, we need more help, support for mental health. Well, we teach them that. We teach them how to have boundaries. And then we get upset when they turn up in the workforce and they're like, actually, no, I'm not going to be doing that for you. So like, be careful what you wish for a little bit. But I love it for them. And I think that every generation loves to criticize the ones coming up below them. I see no reason why we need to think that the generations below us are substantially different or have any less intelligence or willingness than any of us. And in some ways, we need to be gracious with them because they are inheriting an economic system that does not serve them. And, you know, it doesn't give them the promise of security and family life and, you know, hopes and dreams, stability, retirement, and that were promised to us. You know, we can see that being eroded for ourselves, and certainly it's a concern for them. So I think just celebrate them, give them a leg up when you can, and listen to what they have to say.
I know that a lot of my old teammates will feel very seen by that, because I have been firsthand horrified and then been like, oh, hang on, no, absolute respect for your boundaries because you're allowed to have them. We've been trying to teach you to have them. And as a classic millennial, not always had them, you know?
So just to wrap up, what advice would you give to parents who have children in school right now? And what advice would you give to companies as we collectively try to navigate the future world of work and the young people in it?
I'm going to start with companies because I think that's easier, which is I think that the social contract between employers and employees needs revisiting. And of course, we're about to have to reconsider that from a whole new perspective with the advent of AI. But they need to think really carefully about investing in their employees. And there's a sense that, you know, somebody might not be with you for the long haul, but you still have an obligation to help train them for what they're doing for you, but also for the workforce in general. Not least because what is required in terms of training changes so quickly, by the time schools even attempted to build a curriculum for it, it would be irrelevant. But they need to uphold, I think, their end of the social contract. And I think as well, you know, that kind of idea of, well, what could that look like? Work experience is a huge part of that. You know, make those out, get into schools that are near you, go and offer to be a guest speaker, offer positions for placements for people at GCSE and A-level when they're ready to do that. And just connect with young people. There are a lot of charities out there that are doing really good work, particularly for young people who are struggling to find work. So I think I would like to see companies really, and by companies, large corporations, but also the small ones, because this is the landscape of the economy that we're in right now. See what you can offer. Get in there and have a chat. So I think that sense of connectivity is a really critical one for companies to do, and for them to be a little bit wary of making broad sweeping statements about the nature of education if they themselves probably don't have that understanding of child development and what it's like. So be a little bit cautious about that one. For parents, it's, you know, it's really tough. And I think the expectations around parents and their level of involvement in their children's lives and education has changed enormously since we were growing up. So that's a hard one, because I think we are at a time in society where we expect parents to be quite heavily involved in their children's education. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Although Jonathan Haidt, of course, advocates for the fact that one of the things that children really need is the independence and autonomy to be able to make mistakes, to navigate social situations, to figure things out for themselves. And you know, I think that conversation, his kind of tagline is that we over-police in the digital world and we over-police in the real world and we under-police in the digital world, is probably a really critical takeaway, which is, for young people to succeed, they need to be young people. They are not the same as adults in terms of the neural networks, and we need to help build protective spaces including in schools and in homes, for our young people to be bored, to try something creative, to struggle, to manage things. It doesn't mean we leave them with no support, but I think we need to not be afraid to allow them to find their own way sometimes. I think it's a really important message for a lot of them.
Great.
Well, I have one more question. Absolutely well said. And as a parent of a 4 and a 2-year-old, I personally have a bit of a fear of failure just from like childhood stuff, probably GCSE level time. But I've got to unpick that myself, I think, to let them fail and feel that it's all right, because you can, you know, you can turn things around. Personal note, but what conversation should we be having? Because we are going to interview somebody from primary. What questions, what would you like to know from somebody that's in the thick of it at the moment about unlocking this conversation?
Yes. I think I would like to know, I suspect there'd be some similarities, but there are thoughts around assessment. Of course, in primary, there are the SATs in the state sector, which govern what happens in year 6. I would love to know how they find that, reform possibilities. You know, I suspect I have some ideas about what they would say. I would like to know how they are finding some of the pressures that we talk about. I think attendance, special educational needs. Again, I think it's probably quite similar, but I think that's a critical one. I'd like to know what concept, actually the fun one would be, you know, if you get kids to come in and draw a picture of jobs, you know, what jobs do you know about? What kind of jobs are kids coming in talking about these days? Like, I suspect that it might not have changed as much as we think, but I'd love to just see their kind of thoughts about what is work. Maybe having watched their parents work, now that we live in a remote work world, there may be an element of that. So it'd be really interesting to see if like the concept of work from a child's point of view has changed. I would love to see a little picture book, I think, about their illustrations of working life would be an interesting one. And I think one of the other things that's a little bit meta, and my final comment on this one, but is of course, like, educators are also workers. And I think the pressure on teachers and people working in schools is immense. And, you know, we are feeling that hugely in our ability to therefore provide the level and quality of services we want. And I'd love to hear from my primary colleagues, you know, what are the challenges that they're facing in terms of delivering that? Because that model, that classroom model of, you know, a teacher and a teaching assistant is one that is very difficult for many schools to sustain. So like, how are they finding the world of work in primary school?
Great question. Excellent. Thank you so much, Sarah, for being here. It was a really interesting conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. And yeah, let's fingers crossed that there's an audience out there for Education Is Weird Now.
Well, there absolutely is. And for the organizations listening, this should be a call to action, actually. Have you thought about your opportunities to go and provide that work experience, but also about somebody in your workforce going in to present at some local schools? Because my door is open. I don't know if that is of interest to anybody, but I'm always happy to go and present. We should go and present the podcast, Alice. You know, I think we just need to think about it to help the generations behind us. So hopefully a call to action at the end.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Bye.